Reality is discovered, not constructed. Mm-hmm. Aristotle's Politics is just taking reality at its word. We may not like the fact that we are paired animals that are oriented towards the procreation of new life, that we're vulnerable so that we need a community for our medium-term needs and we need a city-state for our long-term protective and productive needs and so on. But that's what it's like. That's the way it is. It's how we are.
Is this then the worldview which in its sort of pop idiocies form cashes out as sex is a social construct?
I think it's completely connected. As the great Etienne Gilson said, metaphysics always buries its undertakers.
Hello and welcome to Socrates Dialogues. I'm Mary Harrington, and today I have the great privilege of being joined by James Orr, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Cambridge and a senior advisor to Nigel Farage. Welcome, James.
Great to be with you, Mary.
And thank you for joining us today. So you have had one of the more unusual career trajectories that I can think of to date. I mean, classics at Oxford, and then a stint as a high-flying legal professional, followed by somehow parlaying that into an equally stellar academic career in moral philosophy at the University of Cambridge, until somehow politics came calling, as it very visibly and quite all-consumingly now has. First, if I remember rightly, it was Brexit. I think now we knew each other all the way back in the day, and I remember being somewhat surprised when I opened a newspaper or an article popped up by two Cambridge academics who were writing a series called Briefings for Brexit. And I got to the end and I realised one of the authors was one James Orr. And I thought, hello, that's odd. I know that name. How's he there? I thought he was somewhere else altogether. So first it was Brexit. And then it was freedom of speech, wasn't it? Or perhaps I got the order wrong there. But somehow, roughly concurrently, it was Brexit and it was freedom of speech. Subsequently, your profile was very much elevated when you became one of the public faces of the National Conservative conference that happened in the UK, you know, to a newspaper, universal newspaper uproar, if I remember rightly. And then more recently than that, you're now politics has almost entirely devoured you as the senior advisor to Nigel Farage. So I wonder, can you talk me through what was the, you know, Walter Benjamin's term, the moment of legibility on each of those issues? How did each of these come to the fore for you as sufficiently urgent to step out from the comfortable position that everybody, I don't think I need to unpack for this audience, what you would assume an academic to think or say or do on any of these issues, to such energizingly countercultural ones?
Well, that's a very generous introduction, a very accurate introduction, Mary. There are very few people who've known me for as long as you have, as it were, at least on and off. And I suppose maybe one always thinks this of oneself. I just think that I'm a still point in a turning world, a world that is turning very, 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 getting faster and faster and faster. And I think there are very few views that I've actually changed my mind on much. Since I was a teenager, apart from Christianity, I think that's probably the biggest. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest change in 2003-04.
So
my worldview.
So you came to Christianity?
Yes. So I grew up in. So I've always sort of grown up, not quite in the margins, but in. I've always been often been a stranger in the worlds that I've been, that I've sort of emerged into, as a sort of strange mix of. Being a stranger and being completely conventional and establishment. So sort of public school, Oxford, you know, Freshfields, Cambridge, Oxford, Cambridge, SW1, Westminster. I mean, at one level, it couldn't be more conventional. But another, you know, I grew up in Brussels. You know, French was pretty much my first language. French and English were my first language. I was always felt myself a sort of English, an English kid, but didn't, without really knowing what being English meant. I just knew that I wasn't French, wasn't Dutch. But then when I went to England, sent to boarding school at the age of 8 or 9, I felt immediately out of sync. And so I suppose that's bred a certain intrinsic heterodoxy in me, mm-hmm. and a sort of suspicion in the direction of the crowd, and a delight in defying it. Mm-hmm. And that was true certainly at school, I mean, I was a Brexiteer as it very, very young. I remember understanding the implications of the Maastricht Treaty in 1992 and thinking this does not bode well. This is not good. And I vaguely remember, I don't know about you, but I don't remember any political thoughts crossing my mind at all in my 4 years at Oxford. I mean, our time at Oxford, I think, was basically sandwiched by Blair's victory in May 1997 and 9/11. You know, this is the sort of the golden hour, as it were.
Where the stragglers
of the Fukuyama twilight.
Where the stragglers from the end of history.
That's it. And then I suppose being basically heterodox in highly conformist intellectual cultures, which the law was to some extent. Law is just intrinsically conformist because what are you doing as a lawyer? You're understanding the parameters of what's possible and doable and sayable, and you learn them, and you're intrinsic. You know, the idea that you might just, you know, burn it all down or break the law is just sort of, or do something or think completely different is sort of is completely off the cards. And I suppose I was caught. I was minding my own business. I mean, I was doing very dry technical metaphysics for my PhD. And when I emerged from that cocoon, the world had gone a bit mad. I hadn't really noticed it on campus, but the first rumblings of the Cultural Revolution were beginning to break in Oxbridge, I'd say 2012, 2013. Mm-hmm. I remember a bit of a fuss about an event on Caravaggio, of all people, that I put on because I'd made some incendiary remarks about him being a promiscuous bisexual. This got me accused of biphobia. And so that was an odd incident. That was in Cambridge. Then in Oxford, I was helping organize a debate on abortion. That got shut down. This is November 2014. And then the sort of rumblings of Brexit, where I found myself at Christ Church, Oxford. I wouldn't say it's right-wing. No Oxbridge College is right-wing or even close, but let's say less left-wing than most colleges, and quite a sort of, and a grand sort of institution. And as far as I know, I've said this before, I think I was the only out-of-the-closet Brexiteer in a senior common room of 80. But among the porters and the groundsmen and the gardeners and maintenance department, the scouts, there wasn't a single Remainer.
How interesting.
It was a perfect split.
Yep.
And I'd be sitting in the SCR and Terry, the head butler, would sort of come up to me and say, did you see that speech by Nigel Farage last night? Wasn't he brilliant? You know, we're right behind you, Dr. Orr. And it was a very strange feeling. To be this sort of reactionary right-winger who just instinctively had a love for the somewheres, for somewhere land. As David Goodhart brilliantly diagnosed it in his post-mortem book, 2017, The Road to Somewhere. And I suppose that is my starting political philosophy such as it is. I think it's also Nigel Farage's... what's wonderful about him is he doesn't think philosophically. He's just got that John Bull instinctive temperament, a very finely tuned sense of where the British people are at. And I slightly mischievously the other day proposed that you can find the basic DNA of Farageism in the opening paragraphs, on the opening page of the first political treatise ever written. Aristotle's Politics.
This segues us. Well, actually, I can see several possible segues into things I wanted to ask you about next. But I mean, it's you said recently in another interview, I think it was with Politics Home, that I may be paraphrasing your exact words, but you were talking about something to the effect that we're living in the dying days of liberalism. And wanting to put forward with you know, through the vehicle of the Reform Party and with the aid of Nigel Farage, what you were calling a politics of national preference. I wondered if you could say a little bit more about that. I mean, the picture that you paint of the split between Gown and Town in your Cambridge days feels like it captures that quite vividly. But I wondered if you could say a little bit, you could expound a little bit more about how you see that developing.
Yeah. Well, it's not a very grand or original thesis, and I think probably the sort of, if there's any kind of post-liberal inflections in my thought, it's not a term I care for very much. I probably stolen most of the ideas from you over the years. But I think it is just, it seems to me self-evident that that long period from 1945 to 2016 was the period of the cosmopolis, of the language and discourse of international preference, of international law, of democratically unaccountable international organizations being, as it were, valorized, and the interests of the demos being subordinated to a kratos that lay elsewhere. And that seemed to me, that still seems to me, the correct view of what's, of what happened in 2016, or at least 2016 being a convenient marker point, let's say. It began, let's say, in some certain continental European countries a little bit earlier than that, and it's happening a little bit later than that elsewhere. But that's what's happening. The old politics of left and right, it's not that they don't matter anymore. They don't. There are still genuine arguments that you could just about recognize as still as happening in the 70s and 80s. But that's not where the energy is now. The energy is now between those who are for the politics of the cosmopolis and those who are for the politics of the polis, of the of polis understood as that outermost concentric circle, which Aristotle lays out in those opening paragraphs, with the inner circle being the koma, the village, and the inner circle being the oikos, the household, the family. So you've got oikos, koma, polis, household, village, city-state, or, in the idiom of Farageism, family, community, country.
So this brings us nicely on to, you name drop Aristotle, and really I just wanted to take us in a slightly more metaphysical direction. It would take us back to the intellectual work that you were doing at Cambridge University, which, as I understand it, I mean, I'm not a metaphysician, I'm certainly not any kind of a serious academic, but it's my understanding that your academic interests lay again in a countercultural direction, in that your research has explored the interaction of scholastic metaphysics with other more contemporary strands in thought. I believe it's the scholastic influences on the work of Edith Stein, is that right? And various other more contemporary thinkers. Because I'm conscious of how abstruse this is in relation to ordinary coffee table books, I wondered if you could tell us, this is going to be a really unfair ask, James, I'm sorry, can you explain what scholasticism even is?
Yes, I can. I mean, scholasticism is a slightly derogatory term that is applied in the textbooks to actually a very rich vein of philosophy that explodes into Europe in the late 12th century as a result of the translation, the discovery and translation of some key texts of Aristotle in logic, in psychology, in metaphysics, in physics, on meteorology, on the soul, and so on and so forth. And that has an electric impact on the intellectual life of Europe in the, this is the so-called 12th century Renaissance, and then deep into the 13th century. This causes all sorts of ruptures. Aristotle is accused of all kinds of heresies and heterodoxies. You have a condemnation in 1210. You have another big condemnation of 250-odd Aristotelian propositions in 1277. But really, I see that as the moment of intellectual enlightenment, in many ways far greater than what is now typically, and rather in a rather self-congratulatory way, seen as the Enlightenment starting in the 17th, 18th century. In many ways, I think you see what's happening in the 16th, in the 17th and 18th century as really the tail end of the twilight of, of a sort of intellectual renaissance that's well underway.
But what
in
it
the
seems,
14th
as much as I understand scholastic metaphysics at all, it's probably mostly your fault.
I've given you lots of things to read, read, unlike many of my students.
You set me homework and I did it. In as much as I understand any of it at all, it's a completely different way of thinking about the stuff of reality itself, isn't it? Which it's a much richer and more nuanced understanding of reality itself, which includes several categories which we've since, with considerable consequences, just excluded from our frameworks altogether, particularly essence. And teleology, which is to say the idea that things have a nature and the idea that things are directed towards some end or other, I'm sure you have many teaching examples that you use in your academic work and can do a better job of that than me. I suppose I'm interested in exploring I mean, if we're talking about essences and teleology, it seems to me that these have a bearing on the questions which you're now engaged with in a much more cut and thrust way in your political work.
Yes, absolutely.
And perhaps the challenges in drawing some of the links between that, that theoretical frame, that long forgotten and really, I think, in my opinion, much maligned theoretical framework, and some of the really pressing political issues that we're trying to deal with today.
Yeah, I could. That's exactly right. And if I may just try and quickly sort of stitch together the politics and the metaphysics, or have a go at doing it, you might say, you know, the central unifying theme is that reality is discovered, not constructed. Mm-hmm. And so in the case of that, the political debate between the somewheres and the anywheres, between the politans and the cosmopolitans, you might say that Aristotle's politics is just taking reality at its word, is mm-hmm. cutting with the grain of reality. We may not like the fact that we are paired animals that are oriented towards the procreation of new life, that we're vulnerable so that we need a community for our medium-term needs, and we need a city-state for our long-term protective and productive needs and so on. But that's what it's like. That's the way it is.
It is how we are.
And human beings, you know, there's the old Robert Conquest line, law, that everybody is conservative about what they know most.
That's right.
And you might say everybody is conservative about what they love most. Mm-hmm. And we love what is our own. And it may be, the idea that we can just have infinite love for all humanity is for the birds. This is why, you know, the eccentric altruists, no, sorry, what are they called again? The effective altruists, they are pretty eccentric. They're fundamentally, and the cosmopolitan vision is not rooted in reality. Flip to the metaphysics. You can say the same is true of the big battle that's ongoing at the moment between the Aristotelians on the one hand and the Humeans on the other. Hmm. Roughly the idea is that Hume's idea is that there are no essences out there. There is not even causation out there. All that is going on, says Hume, is the mind has a tendency to spread itself out upon the world. Hmm. And then to see, as it were, carve reality up in particular ways, and then assume that reality is just carved at the joints.
So is this then the worldview which in its sort of pop idiocies form cashes out as sex is a social construct?
I think it's completely connected.
To me you can draw a line from what you just said, which much more cleverly than I could, to sex is a social construct and therefore I can reconfigure my body however I want.
Absolutely right. Now, I wouldn't blame Le Bon David, the poor old team, for that. In some ways, the Humean condition is the human condition. And he wrote some brilliantly insightful essay. I think he's the greatest philosopher that these islands have ever produced. I think he's wrong on almost everything, but he is brilliant and instructive.
Didn't even he get cancelled not so long ago?
Yes, I think they... Edinburgh University pulled down or renamed a building named
after him.
Probably their greatest, one of the greatest minds ever that Scotland's ever produced. But there are all sorts of other, you might say, constructivist currents in European thought. And you've mapped out many of them brilliantly in your many writings over the years. I mean, you know, think of Simone de Beauvoir. On n'est pas né une femme, on la devient. We're not born a woman, but we become it, right?
So everything that she writes is against the condition that she's already found herself in. So in a sense, she...
I think that's right. I mean, you know, her...
And it's only really with Judith Butler and everything and all that's sail in her.
But the seeds are there. I suppose the seeds are probably more fairly attributed to somebody like Sartre. And Sartre, in his famous lecture in 1946, Existentialism and Humanism, argues that, says that my version, my atheistic version of existentialism, says that there's no God, that existence precedes essence. Hmm. Existence precedes essence. Our first primary grasp of the world is not what we are, but that we are. Mm-hmm. And essence is something that comes along later. We construct it, really maybe through bourgeois convention or erroneous metaphysics. Mm-hmm. But existence is the primary raw state. Mm-hmm. And raw freedom is the condition, mm-hmm. is the human condition, and authenticity is the only value, mm-hmm. Or it is the highest value, and therefore it is the only value. It's all that matters, that you are authoring your own life and constructing your own meanings. And so this is an attempt to sort of really banish metaphysics. You find this effectively, Sartre is in many ways hand-me-down Heidegger. You know, this is Heidegger's great attack in 1927 on In Being and Time, on Cartesian metaphysics. He says that all of this is just since from Plato onwards, we've just had endless confusions about what being really is, what it is to be in the world. What is primary is just the sheer fact of our existence. Questions about essence or substance or subject and object or causation or whatever are simply downstream of what it is to be in the world. And so that's a sort of that's the primary attack in continental philosophy. But as the great Etienne Gilson said, metaphysics always buries its undertakers. And you might say also, to go back to the politics vein, the politics of home or the politics of one's own will always bury its undertakers eventually.
I think though, if you cross the normie mums of Middle England too thoroughly, they will come for you and they will win. Mm. Is my slightly cruder formulation, but ultimately, if you threaten the children, eventually the normie mums will come for you.
I think that's absolutely right. We saw this at the political level last summer with the Epping protests and the emergence of the Pink Ladies outside the migrant hostel in this, I think, late July, early August.
And we saw a precursor of that in the really genuinely very grassroots movement resisting gender self-identification in British politics, which was it's been denounced by various constructivists as an abomination. But it's a more genuinely grassroots political movement than any of its opponents were. All of those were funded by big foundations and various kinds of sketchy quasi autonomous, sometimes really very governmental kind of policy laundering mechanisms. And this was literally just mums organising via Mumsnet and other social media channels and chipping in a few quid each. And it still is.
I think it's the most impressive women's protest movement since the suffragettes, or certainly since suffragism. And I think Britain has a great deal to be proud of. And the part that you played in it and various others was pivotal.
Well, my part was pretty small, to be honest. You know, there are a great many dodgy women who took a lot of flack.
You know, there were dozens and dozens of these brilliant Amazonians who took on the forces of the state, the forces of woke culture. It's easy to forget now. I mean, it's still pretty bad, but really noon of it all in 2020, 21, 22, it was awful. I remember how suffocating it all was. And there was something about the trans ideologues that was almost uniquely violent and aggressive in both their rhetoric and their threats, and I think it's, but back to the Aristotelian point, you know, the more detached you become from reality, the less you lose a grip on practical reason. Mm-hmm. Aristotle is very good on this, the way that theoretical reason comes together with mm-hmm. practical reason, that part of seeing and describing reality properly involves describing and seeing normative reality mm-hmm. properly. Mm-hmm. Aristotle thinks that's a slightly different function, but he says he really thinks you can apprehend the good. You can apprehend goods. You can be wrong about them and you can be right about them. And for Aristotle, our sexual dimorphism, there's a little bit of debate about this, but it is an essential property of human beings that we are sexually dimorphic. And that is a good thing. It's a good thing. It's just a normative thing, mm-hmm. just in the sense that it's normative that sheep are quadrupeds. If you were to amputate one leg from 51% of sheep in the world, such that it was on a statistical distribution, descriptively true that sheep only have three legs.
Nonetheless, they're still normatively quadrupeds.
Everybody knows that they are quadrupeds.
This is one of the most evident, that poor sheep is missing a leg. Now this is a lacuna in contemporary things which it's acceptable to say, which I've been doing ever decreasing circles around pretty much since I started writing. And it's one. It's actually a lacuna which I think we're in danger of reproducing here, because I've finally homed in on the missing piece, the taboo of taboos, the holy of holies, which you cannot blaspheme by actually naming it, and it's Thomas Aquinas. And now, so far in our discussion of scholasticism, we've talked about Hume at one end, and we've talked about Aristotle, and we've talked about the 12th century Renaissance. And somehow still we found it, so nobody has quite been able to mention Thomas Aquinas. So I'm just going to come out and mention Thomas Aquinas, because this is real. I'm not making this up, am I? There really is a no Aquinas rule. That's so taboo, it's not even possible to talk about the fact that we can't talk about Thomas Aquinas.
I think there's a lot to that.
I'm not crazy,
In my defense, when I say Aristotle, I mean Aquinas. He's an extremely innovative, creative, and original thinker. But I think that, you know, there's no question that his intellectual engine room
is Aristotle. Yes.
Plato too, as many are discovering now. And actually, the differences between Aristotle and Plato can be overplayed. But yes. You're right. Now, there are specific historical reasons for that. In 1277, Aristotle gets condemned. Aquinas really falls out of, you know, there's the rise of nominalism with Gabriel Biel and Ockham and Scotus in the 14th century. That gets crystallized by Luther in the Reformation in the 16th century. And then you've got 17th and 18th century, you've got Kant, then you've got Hume. So all of those Thomistic sort of ideas fall away. Until, this is a little bit crude, but really the key moment is 1879 when the great Leo XIII published a fantastic encyclical called Eterni Patris, in which he called for a return to Thomas, a plea for more peeping Thomists to come back on board, and that this was the key intellectual resource to combat the modernist attacks on the rationality of religious commitment in the 18th century. Now, sadly, that led to a kind of what's called sawdust Thomism or manual Thomism, where Aquinas, I mean, you know, the Summa Theologiae alone, 1270 to 1274, is unfinished. It's a million words long. Aquinas wrote 10 million words in 49 in his very, very short life. And so it's very difficult for pedagogically to convey the richness of Thomas's thought. And so in the Catholic seminaries, first half of the 20th century in particular, you have this sort of manual Thomism where Thomas is used as a kind of apologetic arsenal, and it's a little bit reductive and crude. And so that was another reason for perhaps the no Aquinas rule in certain circles. But thanks to Henri de Lubac and other French Catholic theologians in the first half of the 20th century, there was a process called ressourcement, this idea of a return to the sources, a return to the Church Fathers, a return to Augustine, and also a rediscovery, particularly in the second half of the 20th century, of some very neglected aspects of Aquinas' thought.
I mean, I suppose I'm after something very much more mundane than this. You know, you're all up there in the academic finer points, and I just need a reason to explain why it's a stupid idea to give children puberty blockers.
Right.
And I mean, you know, just to take one very simple example, that, you know, somebody who's been cobbled together out of bits against the inherent potential of their normative physiology is not the same. Well, you know, a sausage isn't the same as a piece of meat. Stem of broccoli isn't the same as a cereal bar, even if nutritionally their profiles are identical.
Not on our worldview, of course, but you often hear this phrase, differently abled. Right. Differently. Now, what's hovering behind that? A rejection of Aristotle.
Yes.
A rejection of Aquinas. Mm. Because what's taboo about using the language disabled is that it presupposes a normative way for a body or a person to be. And that is, there can be no normativity. It's a war on normativity. It's a war which is a war on essence. Now, what's interesting is that actually in the early 1970s, even in dry analytic philosophy, you see a return of essentialism in the most unlikely corners, Saul Kripke and Hilary Putnam, who they say, well, look, it is obviously an essential property of gold that its atomic number is 79. It is obviously an essential property of water that its molecular structure consists in two hydrogen atoms and an oxygen atom. And this would be true wherever water was in any possible world. It is of the essence of water and gold that it has those properties. And what's so interesting about those properties is that they're not a priori. It's not like numbers that you think 2 plus 2 equals 4. We can discover them. So for a very, very long time, we did not know that it was of the essence of water that it has the molecular structure that it does. But it did. And so the point is that it's something you can discover. Essence essentialism is wired into the world. So even within analytic philosophy, that is probably really the kind of the fons et origo of a lot of these anti-essentialist attacks on metaphysics, you've seen once again a sort of essentialism surge through.
So would you say that it's fair that your entry into politics has been in defence of, or rather to challenge a kind of political anti-essentialism, which you see as being noxious to the good and to human flourishing?
One of the reasons that Nigel Farage is the most consequential politician in the West right now is that he has an extraordinarily powerful sense of what common sense is, what just normal people think about normal things, about the way reality works. And this is why he enrages so many on the other side, because he loves just puncturing fake orthodoxies that everybody knows are fake, that everybody knows are confected constructions. And there is a sort of, he is at ease with the way the world is. It is the most conservative instinct you can have. You realize that you've got to learn how to go with the grain of the world, grow with the grain of nature, that utopian schemes, moral perfection, this kind of weird progressive Pelagianism is a route to disaster, political disaster and social disaster. Now, he doesn't articulate it in those ways, but he says it, and I think there's an authenticity there, a sense that he is, it's not just authenticity, because there are a lot of nutty politicians are quite authentic. Zach Polanski, I think, is quite authentic, but he's mad, he's insane. But he goes with the grain of nature. He understands what just doesn't work, and what cuts against the grain of common sense. And it's a very powerful, you know, in the end, however messy it might get, reality is an awfully good ally to have
and
on your
reality
side.
Is intelligible, and reality has a way of coming back. Was it the classic one, the classic line from Horace? You can drive nature out with a pitchfork.
Naturam expellas fuca, tamen usque recurret.
That's right. So I think very sadly we have to wrap up in a moment. But I'm always keen to end on a hopeful note, and that feels like a really hopeful note, that somehow both in the metaphysical dimension of your work and also in the political dimension of your work, there's a sense in which the form of things, the nature of things, and also the purpose of things has. In spite of every effort of political and metaphysical anti-essentialism, found a way to fight its way back through, like things growing through the concrete, and this is the movement that you're responding to and keen to nurture.
In the end, we win
because
reality's on our side, and because it doesn't matter how sharp the pitchfork. It doesn't matter how far away you think you've flung nature out the front door, she's always going to come rushing back in. Now, there could be a lot of damage done on the way, and there has been. And, you know, I'm not short-term hopeful at all about the state of our nation or indeed the West. But as I look across the West, I see in virtually every European country a surge in an awakening, a realization that the politics of home, of national preference, of family, of community, of country, that these are the instincts that run with the grain of reality, run with the grain of nature. And that's why I'm confident that in the end, we're going to win.
So we're going to make it. We're going to make it. James, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been such a privilege. And thank you all very much for joining me as well. I'm Mary Harrington. This is Socrates Dialogues. You might be thinking, that's not Eric Metaxas. My name's Mary Harrington. I'm a writer and a past contributor to Socrates in the City. I'm thrilled to be joining Socrates in the City as the first inaugural Socrates contributor. Throughout 2026, I'll be hosting many fascinating conversations on life, God, and other small topics. Be sure to subscribe to get notifications whenever a new episode from Eric or myself drops. And thank you for tuning in.